50 years and he wrote the big book. And he knew nothing about long-term sobriety and often said that. So I thought I'd, when I was 35 years sober, I'm now 39, or 35 years sober, that I would write a book on my experiences, because we're all roughly the same. You know, we have some differences, but not much. And Mickey, did any of you hear my wife talk this morning, Mickey? You notice she was down about like here, you know. So I dedicated the book to her, to Mickey, my wife, the little giant. That's what she is. You know, I often, whenever they say this thing, we aren't saints, the devil inside of me wants to perk up and say, we aren't? let me tell you a story which is kind of typical of the alcoholic. In 1955, and some of the old-timers, I'm sure, will remember that conference in St. Louis. It was the second international AA conference. And at that conference, Bill turned over AA to the drunks. He had set up with some troubles, the General Service Conference, the General Service Board, and he turned over AA to the drunk. There wasn't a dry eye in the house. I was sitting next to Ebbie Thatcher, the guy who brought the message to Bill, and he cried throughout the whole thing, and so did I. We exchanged handkerchiefs. He was a great guy. At that conference, Bill was introduced on the night that he turned over AA to the drunks by a guy named Icky Sheridan, which some of the old-timers here may know, long since deceased. He was from East Texas, and he told the following story, which is so typical of the alcoholic. He said, down in East Texas, we had a little town. We had no place to put a drunk if one showed up. So the decision was made that we would put the drunk in the ice house if one showed up. And sure enough, one did show up. And they put him in the ice house. That night, the sheriff at his dinner table stood bolt upright, and he said, oh, Emmy, his wife, I forgot old Joe. He's down there in the ice house. He'll freeze. Put on his hat and walked down the street and got to this little green house the days when they had ice and didn't have refrigerators. He opened up the big handle, opened up a great big door, and a ray of light sneaked in over in this corner. Here was a drunk all huddled up, who looked up the sheriff and said, for God's sake, close that door. I'm freezing to death. That's the drunk. Let me tell you just a little bit about my own particular story. It's not very unique. Matter of fact, it's not very severe. Many people lost a lot of things when they came to AA, and they were in the down of the low bottoms. I didn't lose a thing. I made more money the last year of my drinking than I ever made before in my whole life. More than I made since, too. That's all right. I remember talking to Brinkley Smithers, who was the one that gave money so that Marty Mann, old friend of ours, could start the National Council on Alcoholism. And he said to me, Earl, you know, he's a millionaire, multimillionaire, long since dead. He said, the drunker I got, the more millions I made. So extreme loss is not necessary for the alcoholic. It's what happens to the alcoholic. I am a physician, and I was always disciplined, but inside my life was a shambles. When I drank, I didn't endanger patients. When I drank, I had a good, nice partner, and we finally split over my drinking, but he was nice for a long time. I would leave town for several days, for a week, 10 days, and then come back, and I'd be all right. Never drunk in my office, never drunk in the operating room, never drunk in the hospital. As a matter of fact, if I went to the hospital at night, I seemed to be protected, didn't have to drink. I don't know why that is. I guess it was kind of the maternal feeling, the way doctors feel about the hospital that they're in. Well, we feel, those of us in the scientific professions, feel that all the addictions are roughly the same. That is, that alcoholism and cocaineism and heroinism and morphineism and marijuanaism, and you go on down to all the isms, that they all are roughly the same. They affect the neurotransmitters in the brain the same. And so we feel that they're all the same disease fundamentally. It's like you had a great big room with different doors that come in, one marked alcohol, one marked heroin, one marked cocaine, one mark, and so forth. Now, in AA, throughout the country, there's a growing feeling in some of the, minority feeling, that people in AA should not talk about anything except alcohol, and should not talk about the other drugs. Well, if you think I'm going to get in the middle of that fight, you're crazy. I don't have nothing to do. But I can say that from a strict scientific standpoint, all the addictions are the same. That doesn't mean these people who say that they shouldn't speak it AA meetings. They have some other drug besides alcohol, and that's their business. We also feel we went through a phase where we thought that alcoholism, addiction of all kind, was a sin. This is kind of unscientific and not true. One went through an era where we said that all the addicts, and particularly alcoholism, because alcoholism is by far the worst disease and it's by far the biggest disease. It puts heroin, cocaine, and Valium and all the rest of them to shame in terms of size. That all the people who are addicted have roughly the same thing in common, and that is an intolerance to a drug. That's the point. And we feel that it's a genetically inherited susceptibility. We don't feel it's a psychological disease. Even the big book implies and says, actually, that it is a psychological disease. Bill thought that, and we all thought that in the 30s. That alcoholism was a psychological, that we were deficient psychologically. We were born that way, and that's why we had to drink and use drugs and so forth. We now know this is not correct. This is not correct. We are just as stable as a non-alcoholic until we get in trouble with our drug, and then we get into psychological problems. The psychological problems follow the excess intake of alcohol or drugs, and they do not precede it. Now, we have people who are psychologically upset who are also alcoholics. We call them a dual diagnosis, schizophrenics, manic depression, and so forth. But we feel that it's a biogenetic inherited susceptibility. Most people, about 85% of people in AA, can discover heavy drinking or addiction to some other drug in their immediate families. In my own case, my father was alcoholic, so was my mother. My mother was less severe than my father. She was a periodic. She would get drunk two or three times a year for two or three days, and she was ordinarily a very sweet, gentle person. But when she got drunk in those two or three days, hugged the wall, she was coming through. That's the way it was. And on my mother's side, I have an uncle that died at the age of 47 from alcoholism. I have a cousin that died at the age of 30. I have another cousin who has been in AA for about, 19, 20 years. And on my father's side, they're all over the place. Excuse me. So I come by my addiction to alcohol. I also got addicted to amphetamine, Benny's. And you gave me a cough drop, didn't you? Maybe you predicted I was going to have a cough. Thank you. God told him. God tells him everything. I did not tell you. And yet not everybody in a addictable family has an addiction. My brother, who is 18 months younger than I, is not an alcoholic or an addict. He takes a drink. He and my wife and his wife, I would go out to Christmas dinner, Thanksgiving dinner. My brother would take a martini and look at it through the light like this. Then he would take the martini and run it under his nose and savor the bouquet and then look at it again, and then he would sip it and have the temerity to sit it down again. During my drinking days, this just drove me crazy. See, why don't you knock that thing off? You know, that's what I do. And for years I said he was a very poor drinker. It's not true. He is a perfectly normal drinker. You see, we as alcoholics know how to drink alcohol badly. We're slobs. My brother knows how to enjoy a single drink. It's totally foreign to me. I don't understand this. But he does. He's not an alcoholic. So not everybody in an addictable family becomes addicted. In 1926, I was then 15. I am now 81. I tried to discover what alcohol was about. Now, when my father and mother drank, we had alcohol around the place, but we were so busy, my brother and I, staying out of their way, that we didn't ever get a chance to try alcohol. And when they were sober, they were the other way around. None in the house at all. And after all, alcoholics don't stay drunk all the time. When I was 15, I went up to a little summer resort known as Russian River outside of San Francisco, about 50 miles, 35 miles, to try alcohol with a friend of mine. We got up there and we found a bootlegger whose name was Ma Martinelli. And Ma Martinelli, you know, when Prohibition was repealed in the early 1930s, she opened a winery and made apple juice. And everyone in California buys Martinelli apple juice. It's from old Ma Martinelli. Art and I, that's my friend, went over and got four quarts of wine. Took them to our tent. They didn't have cabins in those days, just a platform with a tent over it. And two cots, he sat in his and I sat in mine, and we unplugged our bottle, and then we started drinking the bottle. I took a couple of swigs of this stuff, and I thought, hey, this is really something. This is good. So, I paid attention to the bottle and drank it down, sip, drink by drink, until it was gone. Then I looked up, I looked over at Art, and his bottle was about two-thirds down. But he was staring straight forward like this. I didn't know what was the matter with him. I said, Art, Art, and that jiggled the air, and also the plop. He plopped over on the bed. I went over and shook him, and I could see that he was drunk. That's the point. So I put his feet up on the table or the bed and covered him with a blanket. 15 years old, I was against it. We were during prohibition, against the law. What did I do? I'm all alone. Went out, I remember walking down the row of tents, and it was very starlit night, very beautiful. And I remember looking up, and the night was just gorgeous, and I've been very attracted and addicted to nights ever since, that kind of night. I came back in, and I sat down on my bed, and I almost cried. What do I do? Then I discovered his bottle and the other two bottles. Believe it or not, I drank all three of them. Now, that's three quarts of wine for a kid of 15. It's one who didn't kill me. But I, like many alcoholics, was born with a very high tolerance. And I could tolerate large amounts of alcohol. Many alcoholics can. Not all, but many can. That's the way I drank the rest of my life. Well, let's don't go through my career of drinking. It's the same as yours, except I took off and went off. My partner carried the practice and so on. But in 1939, it happened. And what happened? The drug companies put out little packets and little metal boxes. Oh, there'd be six tablets of Nembutal or Seconal or Tuinol and Benny's. I tried them all. And they tasted pretty good. I liked it, all right. But the Benny's took me right up through the ceiling. From then on, until I sobered up on the 15th of June of 1953, Benny's and alcohol were my drugs of choice, and I played them back and forth. Let me skip to my last day of drinking. I had never called myself an alcoholic. In those days, we always thought that all alcoholics were on Skid Row. At least in my area, this was true. This isn't correct at all. Just 3% of alcoholics are on Skid Row. 97% of alcoholics are living next door to you and me. Anyway, I had never called myself an alcoholic. Someone said to me, are you a drunk? I'd say, well, yeah, I don't like the word much, but I am. That's what I am. Aren't you drinking more than you used to, Earl? And I'd say, yes, I am. They said, well, why don't you stop? And I said, well, I do stop, but I can't stay that way. I remember one time on Sunday, this has happened many times, I got very worried about my drinking. Didn't call myself an alcoholic, but I was worried about my drinking. And I remember on Sunday night I said, I'm going to stop drinking forever. I'm going on the wagon for good. That's a very dangerous statement for an alcoholic to make. Dangerous. Nonetheless, on Monday I was okay, Tuesday okay, Wednesday okay, Thursday okay, or reasonably okay, but I didn't drink. On Friday I came home, poured out a large glass of vodka. That's what I drank the last 10 years of my drinking. You know, it's not supposed to smell your breath. It just reeks through your pores, that's all. You know, it's all... And I drank this vodka down. And as I drank it, I said, Earl, I was talking to myself, I thought you said you were going to stop drinking. I just couldn't stay stopped. And that's the way it went, off and on, off and on. On this last day of my drinking, I had found a combination. Well, it wasn't a combination, really, in a sense it was. I found that if I poured vodka over ice, I thought I would be all right. Imagine. Didn't put anything else, just vodka over ice. So I thought I had the problem licked. Well, I went out to a restaurant known as Sam's in Tiburon in California, just across the bay from San Francisco, and I ordered for myself a wearing blender full of vodka fizzes and three double vodka martinis. Now, why I ordered this mess, I don't know, but I did. Drank them down, and I don't recall, I wasn't totally blacked out on this particular day. I was kind of browned out. But I remember a few events. I don't recall leaving Sam's. But I do recall early in the afternoon, one or two, I guess, I was up the side of the mountain. I lived in a place known as Mill Valley on the side of a mountain. And I went up to see a friend of mine named Harry. I'd gone to the university with him. We were fraternity brothers. And he'd been in lots of trouble with alcohol. Now, I didn't go to see him looking for help with alcohol. I had no idea about this in mind. I was not concerned on this particular day with my drinking because I thought I had it licked, one of those ways. But I went up to see Harry anyway. Maybe it's God's plan. I don't know. I went up there and Harry said, you know, I've been in lots of trouble with alcohol. And I said, yes, I've read the papers. I know you have. You've been in jail several times. He said, my wife has divorced me. And I said, yes, I've read that too. But he said, you want to know something? I haven't had a drink for 7 months. And I said, you haven't? What happened to you? Well, he said, have you heard of Alcoholics Anonymous? And I said, well, not really, but I do recall reading an article by Jack Alexander, who later became part of the General Service Board. An article in the Saturday Evening Post in 1941 talking about Alcoholics Anonymous. And in there he said that AA was started by a stockbroker named Bill, who later became a very close friend of mine, and a doctor named Bob. And the fact that there was a doctor and I was a doctor, that's all I knew about, identified with that. That's all I knew about AA. Well, Harry said, here's a piece of paper. And he gave me a piece of paper like this, with two of them that folded together like this. And he said, this is from Akron. And it had on there, on one side, about 12 or 13 statements about alcoholism. And over here, 12 or 13 statements about those people that are concerned about their drinking and want to stop. This is advice to what to do. Well, the scene changes, and I'm now back in my home in Mill Valley, down the mountain from Harry. And I'm sitting on the deck, but I'm so drunk, I just can't make out what it says. So I ask my then wife to read it to me. I've had about 100 of them, by the way. Mickey and I have got 7 marriages between us. I mean, we've been. But we got a great one now. That's for good. It took us a long time to get here, but here we are. So she did. She read it to me, and she read all the statements, and I've forgotten all except two. One said, don't stop drinking for anybody else except yourself. It went on to say in a subparagraph that, after all, it's if you want to stop for your wife or your children, they'll be better, and your wife will be better, and your marriage will be better, and so forth, but you won't stay sober. Make staying sober the main thing in your life. Stop drinking just for you. The next thing she read was, don't consider yourself a martyr because you stopped drinking. Strange statements. Don't stop drinking for anybody else except you. And don't consider yourself a martyr because you do so. Now, for some very strange mystical reason, these two statements made a very deep impact on me. I don't know why. It was like somebody taking a big wet beer towel and just slapped me in the mouth with it. And I broke down and cried. Well, you know, emotional alcoholic. You know, crying was par for the course in those days. I had driving my car. Bing Crosby was very popular then. I love Bing. And I'd drive along and hear Bing sing a song, and I'd cry. I'd look up in the sky and see a lovely cloud, and I'd cry. I'd look up and not see a cloud, and I'd cry. What are you doing? I look at my wife and my daughter and I'd cry. I suppose they looked at me and cried too. I don't know. Finally, my wife said, well, you'll be all right, and patted me in the back and went in the house. And I sat there in the deepest funk, deepest depression I think I've ever had. I'm pretty much of an up guy. I have my down periods like everybody does, but I'm pretty much radiate above the line, or oscillate above the line. And I sat there for a long time, how long I don't really know, in a very deep depression. If I could call it that. Well, finally, I realized it was time to make the... It was on Saturday. Saturday barbecue. I looked at my watch, and it was time to do so. It was about 4:30 or 5 or so. Daylight saving time. Beautiful, beautiful California sun. I ascended about 15 stairs that I'd put in myself, actually. And I got to the top. Remember, walking up those stairs, I was afraid I'd fall out of there. We had no banister on the stairs. Going up to the barbecue area, which is an area about twice the size of this platform up here. I got to the top stair, and I looked at my glass, and I had just about one finger left in the bottom. And I thought, now that'll never do. If I'm going to make that fire, I better have a tall glass or something. So I turned around on the stairs to go down the stairs, on the deck, in the kitchen, to make a drink and take it back up there. As I turned around on the stairs, an absolutely remarkable thing happened to me. I have no idea how to describe it, but I'll do the best I can. It was as though an explosion occurred inside of me. It ripped me apart. Now, of course, it wasn't an explosion, but I felt pain in every cell of my body. To this day, I have no idea why, but I did. And then I heard the words, "This is your last drink." I couldn't believe it. I paused, looked at my glass. I poured out what was in there. I had already had, in essence, my last drink. I never felt so relieved in my life. God, I felt like somebody taking a big, wet, heavy overcoat off my shoulder. The sun even seemed to get brighter. And like Florida, the California sun can't get much brighter. But it felt that way. Then instantly a second thing happened. And that has occurred to me suddenly, "Earl, you are an alcoholic. That's your trouble. That's why you went to see that psychiatrist. Didn't do any good, but he didn't talk about alcohol. That's why you went to see that psychiatrist. That's it. You are an alcoholic." I wasn't afraid of calling myself an alcoholic. It just never occurred to me. Drunk, yes. "You are an alcoholic." At that instant, the craving to take another drink disappeared from me and hasn't returned once in over 39 years. Now, baby, something strange was happening. I later realized this, somebody told us, it was a spiritual experience. Bill and I became very friendly. He had a similar kind of experience. We often shared what happened in his experience and in mine. Now, most alcoholics don't stay sober that way. They get sober the hard way, if you read in Appendix 2. And they have craving on and off. Dr. Bob did. If you read the last paragraph of Dr. Bob's story, he says, "The craving to take a drink was almost with me constantly for the first 2.5 years of my sobriety." 2.5 years. Well, that's not common. That's uncommon, too. But nonetheless, Bob had that craving. But he never was close to taking a drink, he said. You can read it. It's in the big book. Well, I just could not understand this. But I felt absolutely elated. Well, I don't know quite what happened. I must have gone to bed. The next day, I went up to see Harry, and I said, "Harry, I've got to go to that AA of yours. Will you take me?" He said, "Sure." Well, I got to tell you about my first meeting. In those days, we only had 3 meetings in this county where I live. We now have 350, I guess. And he took me to this meeting, and there were 5 people there, including me. There was a table much like this, the table here. And at that far end sat a very wonderful guy named Clark Billingsley, long since dead, who was one of the community butchers. And on this side of the table, that side over there on the table, sat a very short, irritable, bald-headed guy named, aptly called Shorty, only 5'1", who was a carpenter. And on that side of the table sat a very nice guy named Vern Weir, who was a baker. And on this side, next to me, sat my friend, who was kind of a self-styled inventor or something. Well, I want you to know the doctor put himself up at his greatest height. Now, if anybody here is a butcher or a carpenter or a baker, please don't be insulted. And I said to myself, what am I doing in a meeting with a butcher and a carpenter and a baker and a mechanic? Me? So I asked to be excused, and Clark said, "By all means, doctor." So I then went outside Wesley Hall, and I said to myself, "You mean to tell me that you, with all that you have, your professorial status and all the memberships and societies, I won't go with all and all, just so you don't, you're not interested in that. You mean to tell me that you have got to go in there to get those guys, a butcher, carpenter, baker, to make a man out of you?" And I paused. Then the words came to me clearly, "You're damn right you do. Get in there." So I went in there. Well, never has a doctor been so grateful to a butcher and to a carpenter and to a baker as this one. These guys were master clinicians. They know just what to say to me. They know what not to say to me. They know how to handle me. You know, they looked like they had years of experience in clinical medicine. They were just wonderful, these fellas. Well, you know, I just was turned on. I came in AA, still am. Like a Christmas tree. God, I was turned on by AA. And I just thought it was wonderful. I called people. I was around going to all kinds of meetings. There weren't many meetings, but I went to all of them. And finally, I was invited to come to another meeting that was called Jesus as Teacher. Now, this was not an AA meeting, but I didn't know this. This was copied after a man named Sharman who had written a book, Jesus as Teacher. And what they did, they talked about the teaching aspects, not the so-called divinity aspects of Jesus, but the teaching aspects. Well, I invited to go, so I went. It was really a one-upmanship meeting. You know, some guy came into the archdiocese and he said, "You read this on page 92 of such and such a book?" We'd all faint. No, we hadn't read that. No. We'd go home and read it, and we'd say, "That guy's putting us on." We'd come back and say, "No, but have you read what's on page 45 of such and such a book?" And back and forth it went, vying with one another about who was the most spiritual. And I thought, this is what you're supposed to do. So I did it, too. At the end of about 4 months, I was floated way up in the air above a cloud where I guess God sits, and I felt terrible. I went to Clark, and I said, "Clark the butcher, great guy." I said, "Clark, there's something wrong with me. I might just as well be drunk as feel like I do right now." I thought I saw a faint smile go over his face. And he said, "Earl, let me get you a cup of coffee." So he did. He walked way over to the far side of Wesley Hall, and my eyes by this time were on Clark all the time, and in Shorty and Vern, all of them. I followed him over the side. Over there, I just wanted, like a child, wonder what he's going to say, you know. He walked over, and we served donuts in those days, coffee and donuts, and I watched him and watched him. He crossed his leg and looked way off in his face, and he said, "Earl, you know, I'm very proud of you. You're the only doctor we have in AA in these parts." We now have them hanging on every tree, but there you are. He said, "You've done very well, and it must be hard for you, you know, your intellectual status." By this time, these statements made me kind of sick, but anyway, he said this, and he said, "But we have an organization here in Mill Valley," that's the name of the town, "known as Alcoholics Anonymous. Why don't you join it?" I said, "Well, Clark, what do you think I'm doing?" Well, he said, I don't know. But he said, "That other group you go to is perfectly all right. Continue to grow to it, but it's not an AA group." And I said, "It's not?" He said, "No, it's not." He said, "Why don't you do this? Why don't you pay attention to what we have in AA for a while? Go to the other group, too, if you wish, but realize it's not an AA group." Well, this was news to me. I said, "Clark, how would you start off?" Well, he said, I'd go home. "You got a big book?" And I said, "Yes, I got three of them." He said, "Have you read it?" And I said, "Yeah, I read them three times." He said, "You don't learn very well, do you?" And I said, "Well, I don't know what I know." Go home and open it to page 70. Now, the first edition, we didn't call this chapter 5 or how it works. We called it page 70 in our area. That's the affectionate term. We now call this how it works or chapter 5. We didn't in those days. And it's now page 58 or something. It isn't 70. Go home and read it. I said, "Thanks a lot, Clark." And I got in my car and raced home and got out the big book. Here it is right here. And I read, "Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. Those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to this simple program, usually men and women who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves." You know, I went on to say that maybe they're born this way and a variety of things. Their chances are less than average. I said, "There are those, too, who suffer from grave emotional and mental disorders, but many of them do recover if they have the capacity to be honest. Honesty, follow the program carefully, thoroughly, rang through my head. Our stories reveal what we used to be like, what happened, and what we're like now. If you've decided you want what we have, and are willing to go to any lengths, to get it, then you're ready to take certain steps." And some of these we balked. We thought we could find an easier, softer way, but we could not. With all of the earnestness at our command, we beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very start. Some of us tried to hold on to our old ideas, and the result was nil until we let go absolutely. Let go absolutely. Any lengths. Thoroughly followed our path. Rang through my head. Remember, we deal with alcohol. Cunning, baffling, powerful. Without help, it's too much for us. But there is one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. Half measures avail is nothing. It didn't say half measures avail is half, or 90% measures avail is 90%. It succinctly and clearly said, half measures availed us nothing. We stood at the turning point, and we asked God's protection with complete abandon. Complete abandon. Ask for protection. Now, all these things ran through my head, and finally it sunk into my thick, egocentric skull what this program was really about. And I just thought about this for days, and I went on to other things, other meetings, and I read the book more, and I finally went back to New York, and I finally met Bill. We became good friends. We talked about this. And this was a godsend to me because it brought me to this great and marvelous program. Now, let me tell you a few things that happened to me in my sobriety. Let's talk about what we're like now. I was sober about 2 years, and I got up every morning. I had to operate every morning at 7 o'clock, so I got up very early. I got up early in the morning, and I did some exercises, which I still do the exercises. And I was up there that morning starting to exercise, and suddenly I started to cry, softly. I don't know why, but I did. Now, when I have an emotion that occurs to me, I don't do anything to get rid of it. I don't turn on the radio to get rid of it. I don't turn on TV to get rid of it. I don't sing to get rid of it. I want to live with it and know what it's all about. This is what I do. I'm interested in knowing what it's all about. All the philosophies, all the religions say, know the truth and it shall set you free. And I want to know the truth about myself. So I sat down, I was crying over and sat down in a chair by the barbecue area. And I said, what's this all about? Crying, crying. All of a sudden, this is the way change happens, by like that, change happens that way. All of a sudden it occurred to me that I had never been home. I had never felt at home. You know, I would be at one place, and I thought, well, no, this isn't quite it. I should be at some other place. And sometimes, if I could, I went to that other place. And I was fine for a short time, and then, sure enough, it occurred again. This is not home. And I had done this over and over again. Even maybe inside of myself without moving physically sometimes it occurred. Well, suddenly it occurred to me that the only home I could ever have was inside of myself. That being true, I had been home my whole life. I just didn't know it. And I've never been lonely since that time, because I'm always home. Right this instant, as I look at you beautiful people out there, I'm at home. I don't know whether you are or not, but I am. I look out there, and as I stood up there early dawn that morning, realized the home was inside of myself. I looked out all the trees, the beautiful landscape, and I realized that all that was also a part of me because I was looking at it, and it was looking back at me. So look at you folks here. I'm looking at you. You're looking back at me. You are my life, in essence, all of you. And loneliness disappeared from me and has never come back since that time. Another thing happened to me. I was about 4 years sober. And the first few years of my sobriety, in spite of the education I've had, which didn't help me at all in AA, it did me harm, I guess. I had followed everybody. I read books and I tried to copy what it said. I saw people who talked in a certain way and I tried to talk the way they did. A very famous guy that some of you may know named Chuck C. from Laguna Beach, California, became a very close friend of mine. I worshipped this guy. Chuck and I were born the same day. He was 9 years older. He's long since dead. Chuck Chamberlain, Richard Chamberlain's father, the actor. Great guy. Wonderful. I just listened to this guy, everything he said. I tried to talk like he did. Remember how some of you old-timers know how Chuck used to laugh? I tried to do it, and it just sounded terrible. So I was copying everybody, trying to find my place where I'd fit. Well, one time, Chuck and I finally got on the AA circuit. Oh, God, don't get on the AA circuit. I got on the AA circuit, I remember, and I was in Shreveport, Louisiana, and I'd been talking for several years, every weekend and everything else. And all of a sudden, I was standing up there talking, and I heard my own voice, almost vomited. I've been saying the same thing, all of it true, but the same thing in the same way for years. So I withdrew and seldom talk at AA meetings these days. I'm like this, and sometimes I do and sometimes I don't, but not like I did. Well, I was at this place in Midlands, Odessa, Texas, and Chuck and I were the main speakers. I was about 4 or 5 years sober. And I listened to this magnificent guy talk. Oh, he was wonderful. And as I listened to him, for the first time, I realized that I was copying him. I had not really realized that before. I thought I was kind of rehearsing, that's all. But I was copying him. And then I realized with full force, this is the way change happened, by serendipity, like that. You can't make it happen at all. I realized in full force that I had become a copier. I had become a second-class citizen. At that instant, the urge to become a second-class citizen and follow anybody disappeared and has never returned. I decided it takes courage now to stand up on your own 2 feet, go your own way in your own fashion, because many people will disagree with you. So what? For instance, I'm talking here today. If you want people to love you, we're in trouble. It's nice to be loved, of course. That's fine. That's trouble. That's fine. As I'm talking here today, some of you are thinking, gosh, what I'm saying is wonderful. Other ones are saying, what's he talking about? When's he going to get through? And the rest of you are sound asleep. I mean, that's the way it goes. Huh? But that'll make any difference. I keep going on anyway. This is my thing. This is what I do. This is what I shoot off my mouth. At this age, I'm going around shooting off my mouth. That's my occupation these days. I've followed no one since that time. Now, I say to you, don't follow anybody or fend it. Then things will change. Become your own person. Now, what I'm about to say, there's some members of AA will not agree with, and that's all right with me. I'm for whatever, all the people in AA I'm for. You see, there are as many ways to practice, if you want to use that word, the AA program, there are people in it. There are some people who will say, and they have a right to say this, no, there's only one way to do the AA program, and this is it. Well, it's all right. This is it for them, but not maybe for us. We must do it in our own particular way, and if you want to do it in a different way, do it. We all use it. The only thing we do absolutely the same is the first step, we stay sober. That's all. And clean from drugs. We all use the 12 steps in our own way, interpret them in our own way, and establish our own AA program. Do it your way. I speak to the new people here. Listen to the old timers, but don't believe one word they tell you. Because what they may say will not fit for you. On the other hand, what they say may arouse something in you that is wonderful. So listen to them intently, but don't believe what they say. Do it in your own way. Become your own person. Now, I got my physical sobriety on a golden platter. Just a golden platter. But emotional sobriety was a horse of a different color. This came with great difficulty, as it does in most people. Let me tell you a few events that have occurred to me where emotional sobriety came to me in increments. You see, I'll have to say something kind of technical for a minute. It's a matter of time, T-I-M-E. In the physical, material world, there's such a thing as time. It's very valuable. We overdo it sometimes. It took you folks a certain amount of time to collect yourself and get to this auditorium. We'll be here for a certain length of time. And then we'll all leave, and it'll take a certain amount of time to go wherever we're going. So time in the physical world is very valuable. Now, what I'm about to say has nothing to do with physical time. I'm talking about emotional or spiritual or psychological time, and all those three are the same. Emotions, spiritual, and psychological are roughly the same. You can have your own definition of each, but they're roughly the same thing. Time. You see, emotionally speaking, there is no such thing as time. It's always now. There is no there and then. There's only here and now. This afternoon and tomorrow, when you're going along, say to yourself every once in a while, where am I and what time is it? And you'll have to say, I'm now, and I'm here and it's now. Travel a little further, where am I and what time is it? Well, I'm here and it's now. A little bit further, where am I and what time is it? Well, I'm here and it's now. It's always here and it's always now. But you may have traveled several miles in your car from this city to that city to that city. So I'm only talking about physical things. Emotional things, but we have short memories. We forget the fact, it seems to me, if I can use my own case, that when we got sober, it was all of a sudden a flash. Sometimes the flash was very meager. Sometimes it was enormous, like it was with me and Bill and others. We were fortunate. Most of the time it's a meager little flash. Oh, it's happened to all of you, you wouldn't be here. A flash. Oh, I'm alcoholic. Oh, I see. That's why I'm here. Now, there being no time and being no future from a psychological standpoint, there's nothing you can do to change your own emotions except one thing. And that is to acknowledge and accept absolutely the psychological or emotional state or spiritual state that you're in. Nothing wrong with it. May hurt, may not hurt. Start there. Once you do that and accept what's there, because it's always now, strange thing happens. Machinery is set into motion so that change automatically happens and ideas come to you about what to do. Now, if you get into an emotional state and say, I'm going to change it, you're in trouble. We all do this all the time. It won't work. For a while, you can fake it. You can fake it for a while, but in general, it does not work. You've got to accept the state you're in. You say, well, it hurts. Well, what's wrong with hurting? Was there pain? What's wrong with pain? I don't like it. Well, what's... And so on. Accept what's there. Once you do, then the machinery is set in motion so that change will occur and ideas will occur to you about what to do with yourself. The second step says it clearly. AA is very aware of this. Came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Didn't say you restore yourself to sanity. That's what I'm talking about. You accept what's there. We accept the fact that we're alcoholics finally, or drug addicts finally. When that happens, sobriety occurs naturally. If we try to make ourselves stay sober, try to make ourselves get into a new psychological state, we increase the tension and feel terrible. Most people say, well, I don't like feeling resentful. Well, it's too damn bad. You are resentful. I'm not selling resentment, by the way. If you're resentful, you're resentful. You're jealous, you're jealous. You're envious, you're envious. You're happy, you're happy. You're joyful, you're joyful. Accept what's there. And at that instant, new ideas will come to you about what you should do about your emotional state, where you should go, what you should do. But if you try to skip that step, you'll stay in the same bind. That's it. He doesn't agree with me, or she. You see, what you resist will persist. If you resist the fact that you're resentful, I'm not selling resentment, by the way, or you resist the fact that you're jealous, it will persist. Oh, finally, over the course of time and much argument, it wears itself out. That's perfectly true. So accept yourself as you are. Not as you think you should be, but as you are. There's no time to do anything else. There's no time allotted to you to change your emotions. You start off by accepting where you are. I've said this too much, haven't I? And then ideas will occur about what you should do. Now, you know, I had a very great thing happen to me. I was asked to join the faculty of medicine at the Medical College of Georgia in Augusta. And I was on the faculty at the University of California in San Francisco, and they asked me to come out there and offer me a professorship. If I do one strange thing, I'd go to Saigon. Saigon? The war was going on, but they said yes, to go out there, not as a soldier, but out there as a visiting professor at the University of Saigon Medical School to help them set up a new department in my surgical specialty. Well, by that time, I was in between marriages. I'm always in between marriages. You know? And so I said, why not? So I went out. Before I did, I went to spend a couple of weeks with Bill and Lois and some others, Sam Shoemaker and some others back there in New York. Finally, the day arrived, I had to go to the airport and fly to Saigon. Bill took me to the airport, and on the way he said, you know, Earl, I've been sober longer than anyone else in this organization. I was 6 months sober when I found Bob. He said, I don't have very much peace of mind. And I said, I don't have much serenity either. We kind of cogitated about this for a while. Then we left. What to do about this? And I said, well, I don't know, Bill. I don't know. You've been around longer than I have by a long shot. So I flew out to Saigon. On the way, I got to thinking about this. No serenity. What's up? What's up? What's up? How come? How come we feel so miserable? And I decided that I was going to search for serenity out there in Asia by investigating, of all things, the Eastern religions. I was doing my AA work, an AA meeting in Saigon. I've been to AA meetings on every continent, except Australia. I even went to an AA meeting in Iran. That's when the Shah was the big shot. You'd get your head cut off if you drink there, but then we had some Iranians. I've been to AA meetings all over the world, didn't know what they were even talking about, didn't know the language, but I knew exactly what they were saying as I was there. Well, I decided I was getting the grapevine, I had the big book and the 12x12 that Bill had given me, an autograph and so forth, and I was doing my AA things, and I didn't desert my work. But on rest and relaxation periods, I traveled to India, to Indonesia, to Nepal, attempting to find out something about Buddhism, Hinduism, I don't know why, but I did, Taoism, Confucianism, ancestral worship, the whole bang. And I wrote Bill about it. He said, that's a good idea, investigate all those damn things, and let me know how it goes. So I did. And I went on a 3-year or so, maybe more, search for serenity. God, I sat in more temples in Indonesia and in India. We're trying to get into the lotus position. You know the lotus position? I couldn't quite make it, you know. I thought I was kind of nuts, and I guess I was. But on the other hand, I did all this stuff, and I was looking for the serenity. And I kept writing Bill about it. He said, keep going, that's good, keep going. So in India, I did a kind of a silly thing. I was silly or not. They out there, they wear dhotis. You know dhotis that Gandhi wore them. It's a skirt that goes around your lower middle from your waist down, and you pull it up between your legs and make it into a diaper. You know how Gandhi used to walk? That's a dhoti. I put on a dhoti and walked around a dhoti. You know, and I had just a towel over my shoulder. And you consider well-dressed the dhoti and a towel over your shoulder. Why a towel? Because they don't have knives and forks. They eat on banana leaves with the right hand. They crunch up the food and throw it in their mouth. But this hand they use to clean their rear ends, so you don't do that. So I walked around with a towel over my shoulder, and I went to several ashrams, one by Sri Aurobindo, and one by one Ramana Maharshi. At Ramana Maharshi's place, I was there, and I was the only white-faced person with about 150 people. I was there during the season of Diwali. Diwali is like our Easter, the sign of renewal. We were awakened about 2 o'clock on one of the main days of Diwali. I've forgotten which. Oh, this is the ashram. It's like our American commune. It's at the bottom of a mountain known as Arunachala, which means sun in Hindi. And we were awakened at 2 o'clock in the morning, taken into a big room about this size, a tremendous room with big platforms, and on it were big cauldrons of warm oil. And a little guy up there scooping out oil into buckets that we were given. We took these buckets into little rooms, took off our old dhoti, washed our bodies off, renewal, that's the idea. Make yourself into a new person physiologically and get a psychological relief from it. Put on a new dhoti. Then we were supposed to walk around a 9 or 10 mile walk around the base of Arunachala, the mountain. Oh, God. They all went barefoot. Not I wore my shoes. Here I was, this dhoti on, wearing big brogan shoes, walking around, and we were supposed to say, inside the mountain lived Rama, who was one of the Hindu gods. I've forgotten whether I got a million of them. And we were supposed to say Rama, Rama, Rama. So we did. Rama, Rama, Rama. Rama, 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 Rama. Sounded kind of nutty to me, but I did it. Rama, Rama. And it said that if you do this enough with enough feeling, Rama will come up out of the mountain and wave to you and bless you. Well, it's worthwhile. I'm trying everything. So Rama, 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 searching for this elusive serenity. And I got to about the 9th mile or 8th or whatever it was, and I was just so tired I could hardly walk, and I think I saw Rama come up 3 times and wave at me like this. I don't know. Well, I wrote to Bill, and Bill said, you are kind of nutty, but keep going. Finally, after 3 years, now I did this only on rest and relaxation periods. I didn't desert my work or desert AA meetings at all. I was doing those too, but we go on 2 or 3 week rest and relaxation period. And I did this for about 3 years or so, maybe more. And I came home one day just beaten from searching, searching, looking, driving, driving, and trying to do the lotus position, read all these books, and, you know, it was driving me crazy. And I got into my little apartment in Saigon. I just kind of collapsed the floor. I was just tired. I lay on the floor for a period of time, and all of a sudden I said to myself, the hell with serenity. I don't care if I ever get it. And you know what happened? There it was. The search was the trouble. Now, search for things physically, if you want to. A new auto, a new spouse, if you want to, or a new house. But emotionally, it does no good because there's no future. There is no future. It's always now. And I was searching out there, when all of a sudden I pulled in and said, the hell with it. There it was. I never have searched for a thing emotionally since that time. Thank God. Now, when I was out there, I had 50 residents, surgical residents, under my tutelage. They were mostly women because the men were at war. And one day, I was in my little office in a hospital known as Tuzu. And I was there, and I was beating my gums because the notes weren't being made in the chart and the laboratory reports weren't there. What's wrong with these Vietnamese? Why don't they get these things done? Talking to myself and beating my gums, and all of a sudden, I felt a presence behind me. I turned around, and there was a woman named Tran T. Minh Cho. I learned more from Tran T. Minh Cho than I have any place else in the world. And here's what happened. She was looking at me in absolutely open eyes. She wasn't playing a man-woman game. She wasn't flirting with me. She wasn't criticizing me. She was simply open. Our eyes met and fixed on one another. I looked at this beautiful woman, his open eyes, almost fell into these lovely eyes of hers, and she was doing the same to me. And all of a sudden I said, Cho, she could speak a little English, are you trying to tell me that it's all right? A smile came across her face, and she shook her head, yes. She didn't say it, she just shook her head. Then her eyes locked again, open. I never had a woman look at this in my life until I met Mickey.
Boy, I put that in right time. I mean, that's pretty good.
I mean, you know.
I'm a smart guy. You didn't know that, but I am.
Finally, after another period of time, I said, Cho, are you trying to tell me that it's all right? Faint smile across her face, and she shook her head, yes. Now look, loved ones. When you're in emotional trouble, it's all right, baby. It's all right. Be it. Do it. Live it. The trouble is we get into an emotional state and we try to change it right away and we cut ourselves short and change doesn't happen as readily. Accept it. Be who you are. It's different than the person next to you and the person next to you is different than you are. But you're all here in AA. You're following the first step 100% and that's fine. Now, it's all right. Believe me. And from this little 28-year-old, Tran T. Minh Cho, I learned the third step. It's all right. Made a decision to turn our will and our life over to the care of God, as you understand it. He's doing the trip. You're just walking it. He's doing he's giving you the energy. You're just living it. It's fabulous. Now, let me tell you one other thing happened to me, and then I'll sit down. You hear about surrender in AA, and it's a very confusing word. Physically, we know what surrender is. And I'm not talking about physical things at all today, nothing whatsoever. Surrender. Now, what do you surrender? And to whom do you surrender? Well, what we surrender is the ego. Well, what's the ego? The ego is everything that we've been taught that we must do, from our mothers, our fathers, our aunts, our uncles, our schools, our churches, our government. We've all been conditioned to think that there's only one way to look at things. And the ego thinks it's right. There is nothing that's right, emotionally speaking. There only is. Isn't it? Nothing else. There's nothing right or wrong. For example, there's not one thing wrong with any of you or me, psychologically speaking. Nothing. You may think there is, but there's not. It's all right to be the way you are. There's nothing wrong. I think that we use in AA some words that are kind of, I think, poor to use. They're a bad choice of words. Defects of character. I don't think we have defects of character at all. I think we're just at different stages of learning about ourselves. Now, I'll call that defect of character if you want, but to me, defect of character means something you're born with. And this isn't true, I don't think. Go ahead and use defects of character if you want, but I don't listen to those words too much. It's okay to be the way you are. We're all at different stages of learning about life. What are we learning? That we're all one. We're one unit, and we're slowly learning this. You see, we, in essence, are the favored few. Now, to the degree you really believe this, you're going to get drunk. but just listen to it and then forget it. You see, we are the favored few. In essence, we have become a little bit enlightened enough to come here. Think of the thousands and millions of people who will never get into this room. But we have. We're sitting next to people that we slowly and arduously learn to be tender to and with. We hold one another's hands when we say the prayer. Why? Because we're all one big fat unit. That's the idea. Now, surrender. The entity that does the surrendering happens to be the ego, and that's the trouble to begin with. So what do? Forget it. Well, how can surrender occur? Let me tell you one way. There may be other answers to this. Suppose I were to go to Ed here, my old friend Ed, and suppose I were to tell Ed all my troubles, and Ed, being an old-timer, would listen to me with an open heart. He only wants to understand what I'm trying to tell him. That's all. He isn't trying to understand me so he'll get patted on the back, or so he'll get a seat in heaven, or so that I will love him. He only wants to listen and understand what I'm trying to say to him. Now, he may have to ask me all kinds of questions, and he does, and I answer them best I can, but his sole interest is understanding what I'm trying to say and listen to me. Now, what happens to me? Well, I say, gosh, I've never found a guy like Ed. This guy listens to me. All my life I wanted somebody who would hear me, and Ed hears me. He isn't trying to advise me. Advice is nonsense. He's only trying to hear me, and it helps me a lot. So I can decide to tell him more, and I tell him more, and I rub up. And finally, he says to himself, you know, I've done this before. As I listen to somebody like I'm listening to Earl, I see they get all excited and rub up and tell me more. So I'm going to tell him something. So he starts to tell me something, and the further we're fighting back and forth, we yell back and forth, and share one another back and forth. That's the way we do it. And we start out psychologically separate like this, and as we talk and share back and forth, we get to a place where now our psychological states are like my two fingers. They touch. At that instant, there is no ego. Surrender has happened without our knowing it. Healing has happened. And then we transcend and go up just like that, right through the ceiling, the two of us, and we feel glorious because we shared something with one another. That's what it's about. Surrender you can't make happen. It must happen to you by listening. What would happen to you and to me if we spent our whole lives listening to those around us? There'd be no sexism, no racism, no wars. We'd all be around listening to one another. What could be better? Now, this little old organization of ours, kind of a dumb organization, kind of childish at times, it maintains a milieu in which we stay sober. How come? You know, the doctors have helped us tremendously. They've helped us and bring us back to a good physical condition. That's fine. But they are unable to give you and me the kind of sobriety that we've got to have. And the psychiatrists, God rest their souls, they put us on a series of couches and chairs and talk to us and back and forth and back and forth. And even these great persons were not able to give you and me the kind of sobriety that we've got to have. And the men of the cloth, the priests, the rabbis, the minister have prayed on us and over us and about us, behind us, in front of us, and so forth. And even these great men have not been able to keep us sober as we do. And yet, you take a bunch of drunks and a bunch of druggies and you throw them together. You know, if you have 10 drunks down here in a circle like this, 10 drunks all talking, you've got 10 people with a different conversation all beginning with the word I. And yet, we stay sober. A series of perfectionistic, idealistic, demanding, resentful, irritable people get together and yak in rooms like these, and we stay sober. How come? Well, the doctor might say what you've got is psychosomatic medicine. Or what the psychiatrist might say is you've got benevolent interpersonal relations. Well, perhaps we do. Or the ministers, the rabbis, and the priests, and so forth might say, what you have is esprit de corps. But the thing is here that keeps us sober is the very essence of God. God bless you all.